Welcome to the Airport Lounge. I'm your host, Airport. This podcast is aimed at providing deeper insights into all things Web3, including the stories of prominent figures, builders, and community members generally operating in this space. My guest today is Location TBA. Location is one of the four founders of Chiru Labs, the team behind Azuki. He's one of the two co-founders, along with 2PM Flow, who came up with ERC-721A, the groundbreaking contract standard which helped people save gas minting Azuki, and which has since kind of become the default contract standard for NFT projects. In today's episode, we discuss Location's background, his journey to Web3, including his two stints working at Facebook, his thoughts on the space generally, and, of course, what's coming up for Azuki. As always, nothing in this podcast should be construed as financial advice. Please do your own research fully before deciding to make any investments. And before we get into the podcast, I want to take a moment to thank the sponsor of today's episode, Origins NFT. Origins started out as an alpha group with custom data analytics, but has since transformed into a community of like-minded traders and kind of a hub for builders in the Web3 space. It's been my home base since I entered the Web3 space, and the team has been busy building out a terminal with even more functionality, more tools, and a better trading experience for everyone in the Web3 space. So, if you're still looking for a community to call home, do check out Origins, pop into the Discord, and ping me or one of the mods in the comments channel if you have any questions. Thank you to Origins for sponsoring this podcast, and without further ado, let's get into today's episode with Location TBA. Alright, here we go. Location TBA, how we doing, man?
Good. Thanks for having me in the lounge.
Yeah, of course. No, thanks for showing up, man. I wanted to get right into it with this, actually, and sort of ask you, like, a couple of questions just about your background, because I feel like a lot of times people look at Azuki and sort of, you know, obviously we hear a lot about Z, we hear a lot about Steam Boy and stuff, but we don't really talk so much about the other team members. So I want to hear more about what everyone is up to and sort of, you know, how you guys all met, because you guys have been friends for a really long time, right?
Yeah, so the four of us have been friends together for a really long time. Three of us all went to the same high school, and more, you know, full-time employees at Chiru Labs right now also came from the same high school, which I think whenever I tell people that, they find it like really interesting. But yeah, like, you know, Z's doc, so this is not like a big reveal or anything, but we grew up in the Bay Area in California at like a school that was very predominantly Asian American. And so yeah, it's like a really competitive school. I'm not sure if this is like gonna sound familiar to most, you know, people in our community or not, but it's kind of place where like the thing to do after school was to go to the library together and study. Like, you'd see like half the school there and stuff, and like everyone goes to SAT prep classes, all that kind of shit. It was like a really competitive like Asian high school, I guess. But you know, it obviously didn't feel that competitive when you're there, and that's just what you know and what everyone else is doing. So yeah, so that's kind of how we met and stuff. And then we have a couple of employees at Chiru Labs who we know from high school as well. I think it's the kind of place where like it's a really good initial filter on like kind of talent or overall like hard work, you know, whatever, you know, that they come from like the same circumstances and background, and there's like that shared experience, I guess. And so yeah, like maybe half the company is from that high school at this point. So that's been really fortunate to like, you know, hire within our networks and stuff. But yeah, like we went to the same high school, hung out all the time. I still remember the shitty dumb jokes that Z would, you know, fling over during Chinese class and stuff. Still remember exactly what 2PM looked like and stuff, what we were doing during lunch. And yeah, and then we met Hoshi a bit later, but yeah, that's kind of how we know each other.
That's awesome, man. It's incredible that you guys managed to stay friends for such a long time and actually managed to obviously get into business with each other, because that's something that I always find quite interesting. You know, I moved from Canada actually since when I was a kid and to Hong Kong, and you know, since then I never really kind of kept in touch with most of the people that I grew up with in Canada and stuff. But I mean, obviously you guys kind of did your own thing and went to university, studied, and obviously took different jobs and stuff, but you guys maintained your friendship throughout all of that, which is pretty exceptional.
Yeah, I think compared to maybe most people, the people who come out of our school, I mean, I certainly think it is still unique compared to like others in our like class or whatever, but like it's a pretty like straightforward path that most have taken. Like most probably went to, you know, a UC college after, and then they graduate and they work in like, I don't know, big four accounting or tech or whatever, all still in the Bay Area most likely. So like I guess geographically, like there isn't that much like change, like the day-to-day might change, but I think a lot of people still kind of maintain contact and stuff. And so I think that's where, you know, we were still talking to like various people and stuff, and like that's how like subsequent people have been hired at True Labs, who also went to the same high school and all that jazz. So yeah, it's pretty cool.
That's awesome. That's like an incubator for young talent. That's a
I'm gonna be a creepy old dude, go back to the high school, just help scout young talent, you know, help looking around like, hey yo, what's your GPA? What's your SAT? Hit me up in a few years.
That's hilarious. Interesting. How did you decide to become a software engineer then? I mean, because it's, I guess, obviously being an SF and stuff, you're surrounded by tech, and that's obviously like a really big thing. But obviously, a lot of you guys decided to go down the tech route. How did that sort of consideration play out in your mind?
Yeah, I think there's two parts to that question, like people in general, maybe from our background. Yeah, I think it's the kind of thing where, like, you know, Asian families, like, there's only a few realistic paths. It's like, yo, be an engineer, lawyer, or doctor. Mm-hmm. So that kind of already like drives a lot of people towards like the engineering front. I think, like, you know, not to give my age away here, but kind of when I was attending college, that was when tech was just starting to be on the come up, sort of. So I think a lot of people kind of moved in that direction, or, you know, a lot of people who maybe were initially studying something else like switched to it later. That's how a lot of people end up in tech. Like, whether you went to, like, you studied econ as your major or actual, like, engineering, all that stuff, like, all roads, kind of, if you're in that area, you want to get towards, like, big tech, because it's, like, the pinnacle of that, like, field, I guess. Whatever you're doing, like, it's the best role is probably, like, big tech, mm-hmm. and so everyone strives for that. As for me, it's actually a funny story. So, you know that whole, like, Chinese superstition, fortune telling / zodiac stuff. So I mean,
yeah absolutely, yeah, it's like your destiny, right?
Yeah So my mom's side of the family is super into that stuff, and so when I was applying for colleges, I had no idea what I wanted to do. All I knew is that I was kind of good at math and like physics, and so my mom is actually like this puppet master behind the curtain, like reading that shit, and like I didn't know this until way later, but like she's like reading that shit and like the electricity element and like the like fucking metal element was like running deep or some shit or something like that. So she was like like really reinforcing the direction of like engineering. So I was kind of just like, okay, all right. And then so basically she pushed me towards being an electrical engineering major, you know, electricity, metal, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I was doing it, and that shit is fucking hard, man. Like, I was, like, not doing well. I was like, yo, this shit is fucking nuts. And, like, it seems so dumb because, like studying all these crazy schematics and stuff, and then real life the chip is, like, the size of, like, your pinky, like, fingernail or whatever. And I was like, this is hella pointless. And so I tried some CS classes, and I kind of just transferred over, and then that was that.
Yeah. No, that makes total sense. It's funny you say that because after I started working as a lawyer, which again is one of the three acceptable Asian professions, right? My mom found this old video from when I was a kid, and they did this thing, also tradition, superstition, whatever, where basically I think at the child's like first birthday party or something, they put a bunch of professions into little pieces of paper.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
right.
And you have to like – the child goes and picks like something out of the basket or whatever. And apparently I picked lawyer, and they had no idea. Like they totally forgot about this until several years after I had started working as a lawyer. And they're like, oh, my God, he picked lawyer. And so it was like a really jokes thing. I feel like it's – it's funny. I wonder how much truth there is to this stuff. You know, like it's obviously – the logical brain says it's just a coincidence and stuff, but it's like, obviously it's worked out for you quite well. And I ended up, you know, doing
that. No, it's all predestined. Nothing matters. But no, yeah, I do think about that. Cause like one side of my family is super into that Eastern, you know, kind of thinking, et cetera.
Yeah.
One half is not. I feel like I'm somewhere in the middle. Like, yeah, logically I'm just like, no way. But then I just see like all the people I know so into it and like believe it so much. I'm just like, all right, whatever.
Yeah, no, we're in the same boat for that for sure. And it's that whole, you know, illusion of free will thing, right, I guess. Yeah. And so you ended up at Facebook, which is obviously, you know, at the time, I guess, must have been a massive jump in terms of, you know, if we were looking at tech companies that were on the rise and ones that were really great to get into. I mean, Facebook was one of the first ones that was obviously really huge. So, and now it's interesting, right? Because they kind of have become this company that's really trying to make the metaverse a thing, even though their promotional materials as of yet have been kind of lacking. Do you think that impacted your decision at all to start an NFT project and move into this space at all, or was that completely separate?
I think it's kind of separate. I think being at Facebook, hearing about them talk about it and stuff, like, they're really thinking like end goal. I think to me it's really clear why they've made such a big bet on the metaverse, because they don't want to be the one paying a 30% tax on the app store. They want to be the app store. And so they feel like that's the next frontier, and they're betting the house on that.
Right.
And, you know, I know everyone likes to shit on them and things look like crap or whatever, but like at the end of the day, it's all about like who actually gets the adoption and stuff. And so if the network effect actually takes off and everyone onboards onto it, like, yeah, we can sit here with our PFPs that look hella dope and stuff, but like, you know, laugh at them. But if they actually get everyone on there, then like they don't really give a shit. But yeah, I'll say it's pretty separate. Like when I first got into NFTs and stuff, it wasn't about like concept of the metaverse and stuff. They're just like pictures and stuff. And I'm like, hey, this is pretty cool. I think like I saw a tweet recently that was like hell resonated with me. That was just like, I can't remember who tweeted, but they basically said like in hindsight, it was really obvious that everyone who collected like Yu-Gi-Oh trading card game cards like would be into NFTs and stuff. And I think that's like what it is more for me initially, the draw.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally get that. I think that's true also in the sense that it's an interesting intersection, right? Like as much as we have people that are here, you know, who are just speculators, flippers and all that kind of stuff, there is this kind of subcategory of people who just like collecting dope shit and kind of like even just looking at stuff and sort of like taking in the collections and sort of discerning rarity. And I think that's something that even if, you know, you were kind of into when you were a kid, but kind of lost growing up, it's still fun. You know, like I used to be pretty big on Yu-Gi-Oh cards, pretty big on Pokemon cards and stuff. But I kind of didn't keep that up when I was an adult. But getting back into NFTs, I was like, wow, this is like kind of dope. It actually like speaks to some kind of primal desire. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yo, funny story. I was at a friend's wedding recently. So it was a bunch of like old high school friends, like my close friends, mm-hmm. all together for the first time in a while. And so we're just like thinking of things to do. And I was just like, yo, let's just go fucking buy a shit ton of Pokemon cards. I mean, Yu-Gi-Oh cards and like assemble decks and let's just duel.
Dude, that sounds awesome.
And I was just like, yo, let me hella lit it. Like, you know, that's basically, imagine like teenager you with like no money, like hella scrounging together, like some sense to buy a booster pack, you know? Now, like, you know, you actually have disposable income. Like, let's just walk in there, you know, just fucking buy out the whole store, create some crazy decks and let's get it going. So we basically went into like the closest hobby store we could find. About like $400 worth of like packs, oh my God. Which like translated to like fucking like 100 booster packs or something. And then like hell excited and amped, and like we all like split it up, opened it up, ready to like assemble our decks and duel each other. And then the moment we opened it up, we realized that like, holy fuck, like we're way too boomer for this game. Like, dude, it's so complicated now. Like the actual text on the cards, the font is so fucking small. There's so much text and mechanics. Like I was like, dude, where the fuck's the trap hole, dude? Like this shit is way too complicated. And so like, yeah, like we spent like an hour just trying to read every card and understand what the fuck's going on, assemble our decks, and then I lost in like two games. My friend made like a hella OP deck. I was like, this is bullshit.
That's so, jokes. No, we had some kids in my high school that were really into it. And even then, like, cause you know, you kind of think of like the old school Yu-Gi-Oh where it's like, oh, just play Mirror Force, whatever, bounce back people's like trap, whatever. Yeah. But like now, yeah, it's crazy. Like people are winning in like one turn and it's like actually nuts. Like I had a buddy in high school who was playing and he had a constructed deck and he was actually trying to play competitively. And I think he actually had an unironic or one turn kill on the first turn back when I think like a couple of the cards weren't banned or something. It's just so ridiculous. The power creep in that game was absolutely fucking messed up.
Yeah, so TLDR is, it's hard to make games. Game mechanics are tough.
It's true. And so what exactly were you doing while you were at Facebook? I'm curious.
Yeah, so I was actually at Facebook twice. Mm-hmm. First time around, I was on the revenue team. And so this is where I kind of first like was at a big company, because before that I was at like a really, really small startup on mobile games. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of where I understood what processes, how it all works, you know, working with like other people who aren't engineers or product, like figuring out how all these things work and stuff. So it was a bunch of boring finance revenue stuff like that. And then I left and went to a different startup after a couple of years. And then when I came back to Facebook, I was on the charitable giving team, because that was a team that I always kind of admired from afar. Because like whatever you want to say about Facebook and stuff, like the things that happen on the charitable giving team are like tangible. You ever see like, I don't know who still uses Facebook now, but like, you know, like back then it goes like, oh, you know, it's my birthday and I'm holding a fundraiser for this so-and-so charity, etc. That was the team that I was working on. So when I went back, I had a couple of options and decided to just do that one, just because nonprofits and like charity essentially is like pretty meaningful to me. So I went there, working on a lot of the payments stuff, kind of like getting it like going on like Instagram, stuff like that. And yeah, so also fun aside, the company I was at in between the two Facebook stints, I was the lead payments engineer as well. So I kind of like, without any intention, was like doing like payments eng type work for like my entire career, which is like somewhat specialized. And that's why when I discovered the blockchain and stuff, I was like, well, all right, you just fucking made my whole career like pointless. But, all right. That was really what drew me in. Cause like when I first started doing like the zombies tutorial or whatever to learn ETH and stuff, and like playing around with code and seeing how like, oh, you can basically accept like anybody from anyone. It's forever scalable. Like with these few like lines of code, I'm just like, well, all right, fuck you. But it's pretty cool.
No, I 100%. I totally get that. And that's fascinating. I want to, before we move on to the tech stuff too much, I want to ask you about this charity thing, because we've talked about this, right? And you said that you care very much about this giving aspect and this charitable aspect. And I remember that you used a term when you described it to me the first time, but I forget it now. It was something like impactful...
Effective altruism?
Effective altruism. That's what it is. Yeah. Could you explain what that is?
Yeah, effective altruism is a type of altruism where instead of like donating to like your local church or some kid's lemonade stand or whatever, it basically asks one to think a little bit more deeply around like the efficacy of like the dollar being donated. So it's more like taking a really analytical approach, doing a lot of analysis on like charities, like how much of the, what percent of each dollar actually ends up towards the cause. And then it also believes that not all causes are equal. You know, like you might have a charity that's like, hey, donate, you know, $100K to train a dog who can help blind people in the US or something. But then effective altruism would say, no, you should probably donate that to like perform like low cost like eye surgeries to people in like third world countries, because that goes a lot further than like one's like dog, I guess. So yeah, so that's kind of what it is in a nutshell. Mm-hmm. I kind of like stumbled onto it early in my career. You know, I grew up in a, you know, relatively well off family, like, you know, upper middle class. My whole life laid out in front of me. You know, I'm at big tech making so much more than, you know, most of the world, certainly in the top like 1% of the world. Got to a point where I was finding it hard to like justify like this inequity. I was like, how is it fair that like, you know, I work at Facebook and make so-and-so and like there's people around the world starving and stuff. And then so that was kind of something I was struggling with for a while. And then, you know, even thoughts of like, I should quit my job and like just go try to like help the world, etc. And then that's kind of when I stumbled upon effective altruism, which is like, yo, it's really cool that you might want to join the Peace Corps, but like honestly, like fuck that. You should like excel in your career, get as high up as you can, grow like the amount of money you make as much as possible, and like commit to donating a percentage of like your income towards these causes, because that overall would have more impact than like, you know, you being in some third world country like volunteering or something. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how I stumbled onto it. It might have been like the answer for, you know, the internal conflict that I had at the time, but it's a pretty rational approach in my head, and that's why I've stuck with it.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because I had a buddy in university, in law school, who was really, really adamant about wanting to go to third world countries and build houses with his bare hands. And he was like, you know, I'm going to go to these places. I'm just going to quit law school. Like, I'm not going to become a lawyer. I just want to go and get my hands dirty and like build these houses. And I kind of said to him, I was like, look, I think there is a lot of people who are in a position where they could go and do something like that. But you're in a unique position where, you know, you're getting top grades in your class, you're doing really well. If you really hate the system, or if you really feel, you know, a certain kind of way, you know, just don't forget the person that you want to be and kind of do the job, but donate a big portion of what you make to causes that you really care about, because like these foundations and organizations all need capital and stuff. And he kind of ended up following my advice. He actually went to Harvard in the end, and then sort of went and, you know, became a really, really serious lawyer. And so I think definitely the right call, but it's an interesting take that you're providing here. What was Facebook doing with their charitable giving that you think worked so well?
I think one, obviously they don't give a shit about it from a revenue perspective. Like they don't make money on that. That's like a, I think it started off as like a hackathon project, and then they eventually just turned into a team and then just grew and stuff. I think they do a lot of interesting things. It's like you have a huge network of like people. And so like you can like blast charitable causes and certain like events or holidays, whatever, giving seasons, et cetera, to these people and raise money. And they basically just forward it all to charities. Like, you know, I don't know what leadership thinks what the motivation is behind it, whether it's like just, you know, PR, you know, nice things, or just like whatever the case. But the end result is that like they raise millions, if not hundreds of millions, for these charities. And they also eat the credit card processing fees. Oh, wow. So quick plug, like if you ever were planning on like donating something, like you can just do it through Facebook potentially, and you can still get your credit card points. that's the best way to do it. But yeah, that's basically what it was. And like, you know, it still functioned as like a typical like product team. You know, there's like KPIs and metrics that are trying to hit and stuff. But the interesting thing is that the metrics is like, you know, number of people that we can get to donate, or like money raised for charities, et cetera. So it's pretty cool.
You know, it's funny, if it is for a PR thing, they should definitely advertise it more, because I actually haven't heard so much about this. But the interesting thing is, I think a lot of people talk about the issues with working in nonprofits or charitable organizations just sort of being that it's hard to attract talent. And I think that's unfortunate, right? Because it's actually a lot of people who, you know, the best and brightest in a way should be dedicating themselves in some respects to bettering the lives of other people rather than just working in a company and trying to generate as much profit as possible. So I do find that interesting that, you know, a place like Facebook would have an outfit like that, just because, again, like, you know, it would be quite sophisticated, I'd imagine, you know, working with good minds, good people to actually, you know, have an impact.
Yeah, for sure. The good thing is that, like, you know, everyone who chooses this team is like, they're there for the cause. Like, if you wanted to like really optimize for like career progression and stuff, you'd want to be in a highly visible place, like, I don't know, Instagram Reels or the metaverse related stuff, et cetera. But, you know, not something where like the company probably doesn't really care about it when it comes to like the bottom line. So it already kind of pre-filters into all the people who really like care about the goal or the mission, I guess, which is pretty dope.
Yeah, no, that's dope. And so what do you think about the potential for NFTs as, you know, a medium for charitable things going on? I mean, I think with the Ukraine thing, I think it was Andrew Wang who worked with some of the people. I think Zeneca maybe was involved as well, but they raised a bunch of money for the Ukraine. I think they raised like $1 million or $2 million or something like ridiculous in a very short span of time by dropping some NFTs. I'm curious what you think about the potential for the space for charity, mostly just given that, you know, it's has access to a lot of people from different places. It's very easy to accept payments, all this kind of stuff. Like, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think there's massive potential. I haven't really thought about it too in depth, to be honest, because I'm so like slammed with like Azuki stuff. But I think to me, like, I think about like economics and how money flows and works in our world a lot, because I think it underpins like everything. And I think, like, you know, we're all here because we believe Web3 and the blockchain is this like new paradigm around like how money and value like rests within like people, I guess. And so that's the thing I find really interesting. Like, I feel like there must be something there. I haven't spent the most time thinking about it, but yeah, I think like I'd be really interested in kind of diving more into that, like, you know, down the road, how to actually like utilize this technology to try to create like a bit more like meaningful impact in the world around us, assuming I don't die from exhaustion from Azuki.
That's a great segue to move on to, you know, Azuki things. But one of the things that is a burning question on my mind, and I think is something that is quite interesting, right, is you obviously as a startup founder now have to wear many hats. I can imagine, you know, obviously coming up with the ERC-721A, which I'll ask you about, you know, later. But obviously doing all that stuff from the software engineering perspective is, you know, something that you were tasked with initially, the smart contract and maybe putting together the website, I guess. But after all that stuff is done, there's not a ton of software engineer stuff to do, I would imagine. So what does your role kind of become after the smart contract's done, Mint's done, all that stuff is done? What are you busy with on the day-to-day now?
So Without giving too much away, there is a lot of engineering happening still. Too much.
Mm-hmm.
But to kind of take a quick step back, like, you know, post-mint, you know, obviously before the mint, I was purely focused on engineering. After the mint, I kind of was spending a lot of time on the operation side of things. Like, okay, you know, before this thing, you know, minted out, we're just like a project with the four of us and some people helping us. And then there's a lot of work, like initial work, taking that and turning it into like what it is now, which is a company of like 14 to 15 people. So that definitely took up a lot of my kind of mindshare at the time. I think more recently, you know, with the company not growing at as rapid of a pace right now, mostly because like don't have time to go out and like recruit people and desperately need a recruiter, quick plug. I've been kind of shifting back more to product, but not like necessarily engineering. I'll try to like help it, like help out here and there, because our deadlines are certainly tight. I think I do a lot more of like product management, sort of, kind of acting as that layer in between Z, who's like the creative mind behind it all, and like the rest of the company, who are the actual people executing on the stuff day to day. Yeah, that's kind of what my roles become. Definitely not a product manager by trade. So there's a bit of like a learning curve. But, you know, obviously as someone who's worked with product managers all over the place, understand like how it works and what's the purpose of it. You know, like to think I'm, you know, reasonably smart. Like that's kind of the role I've taken on. So it's kind of, I think it's really interesting balance, because I feel like for an engineer, I'm definitely a lot more maybe product minded than maybe like the average engineer. And so I kind of act as like that in between, like compromise point between all the pieces. Like, no, we can't just always do everything that you think is dope Z, because like we got to make sure we can actually like handle doing it. By the same time, like I have a lot of input on like the product itself, how it should work, etc. So I'm kind of like a shitty product manager with a lot of like engineering context, I guess.
Yeah. And what about the other, co-founders? Like how did they sort of, what kind of roles have they settled into with after sort of the initial mint?
So there's three other co-founders.
Right.
One is Z, 2PM, and Hoshi. So I think Z spends a lot of time like thinking big picture, talking to a lot of people. Maybe like the kind of things that you'd associate with like a CEO, I guess. 2PM is the CTO. So he basically just like manages all of the engineering. He's like a, you know, in a previous life, he was an engineering manager at like top companies and stuff. So he's like really deep on like the engineering expertise, like really great, and kind of runs the engineering team. And Hoshi Boy is the chief product officer. So thinks a lot about like the branding, the products that we create, the experiences, design, all that kind of stuff. And so I think like me with my role, like has always been to like fill in the gaps. I've always like gravitated more towards being like a breadth over depth kind of person. And I feel like these three are like definitely more on like the dev side. Like they're deep into like their specialty, I guess. And so I kind of sit in between the three of them and kind of make it all work, or at least try to make it all work like harmoniously, and like disseminate it out to like the rest of the company. And then like, yeah.
Yeah. It's funny. We share that actually, because I had to come to terms with my own identity as someone who is more into breadth rather than depth, because I just didn't want to be that person who was, you know, absolute top of my game at one particular thing. It was always like, you know, I had massive shiny object syndrome and was curious about lots of different things. But, you know, I think it's, I think you kind of need that, right? For anything. I think you need someone who is, you know, has that kind of myopic focus on the thing, but also people that tie it all together and have enough literacy to really bridge that gap between different things. Otherwise, the organization just can't run.
Yeah, no, I feel you. I'm always the same, like just like looking at shiny objects, like I put together like concepts or like MVPs of things. And then it's like, okay, that was cool. I learned like the stuff to it takes to do that. And then, all right, what's the next thing? So
yeah,
definitely similar.
100%. So the question I have then is, and this is like, I guess something that I didn't really think about before, but I think is I'm really curious about now, is how do you guys approach like ideation and brainstorming and figuring out what you want to do? Because obviously, again, a lot of different perspectives, a lot of different thoughts. Z is the, you know, maybe the creative visionary in certain respects, but how does that all tie together with, you know, product and things and you guys discussing what's possible and what you want to do?
Yeah, I think the four of us talk a lot about like how the space is, where it's going, where do we see like Azuki growing with that, etc. So we kind of have like general alignment on like, you know, what we want to do. And then when it comes to like more figuring out what exactly you want to do, I think we approach it from a pretty normal tech startup kind of route, I guess. Like we kind of do some brainstorming. We think about what are the top goals that we want to achieve with certain things. Brainstorm, think about things to do, etc. And then, you know, we'll like create product specs and work on it, disseminate it out to the rest of the company to, you know, work on like smaller and smaller pieces, etc. While staying really like flexible because we are a startup and the space moves so fast. So like we definitely adjust a lot. That's certainly like one thing that we kind of are still sort of figuring out, like how to balance like, you know, everything, not biting off more than we can chew. I think we often bite off way more than we can chew, but that's the dope part of it. Like you don't want to be in a situation where like you have no ideas. And so, yeah, we got a lot of dope stuff cooking and hope you all enjoy it soon.
Yeah, dude, I'm super excited. I feel like the nice thing is Azuki's one of those communities where thankfully people are not too sort of, you know, kicking up a fuss and people kind of left their own devices. Because one of the things that I kind of struggle with in this space as of right now is I think a lot of communities are, especially early ones, I guess, and maybe this was more of a feature with Azuki earlier on, but I think people, you know, really did not kind of trust the process and kind of, I guess, have this idea that things need to come instantaneously. But, you know, the reality of things is that obviously it takes time to do things, right? And if you guys are obviously trying to scale out and hire people, that's a huge, you know, spend of your time and resources to try to figure out like how to scale the operations and stuff. But, you know, people kind of want things quick. So I don't know, what do you guys think about that? I mean, it's interesting because our community is pretty solid in terms of not really being too like, oh, we need an announcement now, we need something now kind of thing. Like people do kind of actually embody the whole mantra of trust the process, which is interesting, you know?
Yeah, I think it's like finding a balance. Like it's certainly not our DNA to be out there like tweeting every day talking about like, oh dude, you know, wait till you see what comes out next week, this shit's gonna be fire. But you know, it's a balance. Like we obviously understand like real products and like infrastructure and all that kind of stuff takes a long time to build, but at the same time we're not gonna like, you know, put our heads down and be like, okay, we're gonna make so and so, see y'all in like 2 years. It doesn't really make sense, especially in this space. And so yeah, it's just finding the balance. I think we oftentimes are just like, you know, that's basically one of the things that factor in when we decide like what we want to do, like what's the speed at which we can like put this out at, because it's always top of mind for us that like, you know, people are expecting things to happen. Do I think the expectation is like justified? Like kind of undecided. Like I understand why everyone expects a lot of stuff, like, you know, in terms of like the speed. And so it comes with like being in the Web3 space and like, you know, none of us are like, you know, regretful of that at all or whatever. It's just another like kind of thing that we have to be conscious of.
Yeah. No, 100%. Totally get that. What are you most excited about with Azuki right now? Because obviously things will have changed dramatically since, you know, Mint and sort of since things got started. But what do you, I guess, look forward to with what you're doing in terms of, you know, obviously creating dope shit and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, there's obviously more granularity to it than just that, right?
Yeah, I think the thing I'm most excited about is probably like how the space is going to play out. Like, I think one of the strengths of our team is that, like, we really take everything in and make, like, calculated smart decisions with the information that we have, and we'll, like, place a bet or something. And so, you know, we might not necessarily be, like, a Bored Ape that's, like, okay, we're going to just build the metaverse, because that's a lot of open questions. Like, you know, AAA gaming studios spend years making, like, a game, and it just, like, flops most of the time. Or, you know, we're not going to be out here like we're going to build some Web3 social network that will have 1 billion users and that's how everything will make sense. It's just like, well, you know, we know what it takes to actually make a product like that. It's not that simple. But I think we're really good at like seeing trends and like what makes sense for Azuki, what works well. So I think I'm more like excited about like the potential of the space still hasn't changed at all with the bear market and stuff and how like Azuki fits into that. Because I think like where you don't want to be is like, you decide you're going to place this huge bet, we're going this direction, and then like 6 months later you see that like the space has like diverted away from where you think things were going to go. And that's kind of the spot you don't want to be in. I think for Azuki specifically, I'm really excited about kind of like the makeup of the community that we have right now. It's like a very interesting blend of creatives and obviously like whales slash investors and even operators and stuff. It's a very cool blend of people. And I really do feel like we have the most creatives in the community. And I think it's all thanks to like Arnold's art. It's just like speaks for itself. And that's what attracts everyone to it and stuff. And so I think exploring more how to like empower these creatives, like all of you all essentially, to kind of grow the brand with us is also something that I find really interesting.
Yeah, that's dope. I did kind of notice a while back that a lot of people who are, you know, pretty serious artists on Twitter and, you know, who've been putting stuff on Instagram and sort of, you know, publishing artwork basically for the longest time are, you know, in the Azuki community. And I love to see that, right? Because I think it's really cool that a lot of these independent creatives have kind of taken the PFP and chosen that as their icon or their community of sorts, you know, because it is one of those things where the creative element and the art is actually a very important part of the whole process and part of the whole experience, I guess, of being in the community. So it's really cool to see all of that and attracting all these people, like you're saying, you know. And I think it is a very diverse community, and I can't speak for other communities, I guess, because I don't really spend a significant amount of time interacting with so many other communities, because obviously that's just, you know, a lot of time, and Azuki's kind of my home base, if you will. But definitely sort of feel like the Azuki community is something special, which is kind of cool, right? Like it's you don't really set out with any certainty that that'll happen, but it's kind of cool when it does happen.
Yo, I just have a better answer. Forget everything I just said. Okay, here's the thing okay. I'm most excited about. I think what I'm most excited about is the potential to like make anime mainstream and cool. Like it obviously is like kind of mainstream, and it's like this form of media that, you know, theoretically most of the community has like really appreciated for many years. And, you know, anime has been on the come up for like a long time, but like, I don't really know if like more of the mainstream really thinks anime is cool yet. Mm-hmm. And I think like the fact that like our PFP and the brand is centered around like these anime characters, we really have the potential to like do something cool here. So like, it just feels like there's something there. There's obviously something there. Like, you know, like we all know that like, you know, hell, NBA players all watch like anime. Like it's really like, you know, crossed over into like American culture recently and stuff. And the kind of opportunity to like be at the center of all that, doing like dope shit revolving around anime, that's also really exciting. But I mean, yeah, the previous answers are, you know, pretty good too, but anime is dope.
Yeah, no, I feel that. I think with respect to that in particular, it's funny because I feel like when we were kids, it was super not cool to watch anime. Like if you watched anime, you were like, you know, not at all, like you couldn't hang with the cool kids. You know, you were some loser who like was destined to live in your mom's basement kind of thing, which is kind of sad. I think maybe that was also partially growing up in North America, but I definitely feel like it was definitely not a cool thing to do. But somewhere I feel like in the last maybe 10 years or so, it kind of became more mainstream and people started talking about it. And maybe that's just the benefit of the internet, right? Like people coming out and saying like, hey, actually I love anime. Like it's dope. And I was talking to my sister recently about this, who she was kind of convinced that anime was for kids and like, oh, it's cartoons and stuff. And I was like, dude, it's a great medium for telling the best stories. Like I got her on Hunter x Hunter and she watched the whole thing in like under a month, which was like, you know, really fast. And she was like, yo, this is fucking dope.
Yeah, I feel like once the bug bites you, it's over. Like, there's nothing that can compare to, like, the expressions and emotions that the anime can convey compared to, like, more traditional forms of media, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think about all these projects that are out here trying to make an anime? Because this is one that I'm always super skeptical about, right? Like, whenever projects are like, oh, we're going to, you know, drop these NFTs and then we're going to go make an anime, I'm kind of just like, I don't really know. Like, I haven't seen a proof of concept yet that makes any sense to me. I think it's kind of almost the same as when people say they want to go and make a game. I'm always like, you know, first of all, how do you intend on doing that? Because it takes a huge amount of time to do that, and there's no guarantee it'll be good. I think the second thing is if a AAA studio with a lot more experience, a lot more funding, and just expertise, honestly, comes in and tries to do it, they'll be able to knock whatever you're doing out of the water, right? Like, I mean, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting one. Like, I think there's a reason why a lot of like the popular anime is you know, stems from like an existing like webcomic or manga, because there's like already an established IP that you know hits. And so trying to make like original IP as an anime is an extremely risky bet. Yeah, I think we all generally know how much League of Legends spent on like their anime, like a shit ton. It's definitely going to be a really cost intensive and expensive like endeavor for sure. I think if anyone figures out how to really interestingly work NFTs into anime, that could be really interesting. Beyond just like, oh, hey, maybe, you know, you'll see your character in there. That's not that cool, in my opinion. And especially if like collections are like thousands in size, like you can't cram 1,000 characters into an anime. So yeah, would I love to see an anime do really well based off of an NFT project? Yeah, if one does, I'm probably going to fucking buy a floor for sure. But yeah, it's tough. And it takes a long time.
Yeah, that's the big thing, is it takes a really, really long time to do. So I always feel like when, especially in this space, right, again, where people kind of want to see progress happening all the time, it's always a tricky one, because it's like, well, how do you balance the community aspect and sort of trying to keep people satisfied with the fact that they just paid X amount of money for an NFT for this anime that'll come out maybe in like a year and a half or something? You know what I mean? Like, there's just so much stuff that's going on. And even with experienced teams that are trying to do it, I think people approach this with the best of intentions and with, you know, really good ideas sometimes, but it just kind of ends up being the case that, you know, how do you do this? And I just don't really see it. I think gaming's even worse in a way, right? Because it's like, I think there is room for these like indie type games, which would be awesome. You know, if we have like a small scale game that's just really fun and somehow NFTs are built into it. But I feel like the model right now, it just doesn't make sense, because everyone's like trying to drop land and then they're trying to, you know, like build around it. I'm like, bro, how are you going to get people to play your game if a bunch of whales already own all the best real estate or all the best shit in the game already? Like, it just doesn't really make sense. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I'm dubious on like the metaverse game stuff. I think games in general is interesting. Mm-hmm. And the goal should be like, how do you actually make a good game that's fun that people want to play? And then like figure out how to like integrate NFTs into it potentially. Not like have an entire game revolve around like the NFTs necessarily. Yeah. So I think like Web3 gaming is certainly interesting, but yeah, I'm not particularly bullish on all the land sales and stuff. But yeah, I still think it could be dope. Like, my first job was at an early stage startup in mobile gaming. And like, obviously it's a different time period, because that was when like, you know, mobile was just taking off and like competition was surely like less competitive then. Mm-hmm. But I think people can build games. Like, that's something like you can kind of hire for and like get, or potentially partner with the right like studio or teams or whatever, and kind of design a great game and stuff. But like an anime is like, that shit is like 2 years minimum. You know, everyone wants to make a top anime. It's going to cost a shit ton of money, and you're competing against like established IP from like manga. Like, who's going to watch your shit over like One Punch Man? Mm-hmm. Not me.
Yeah. But yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's right. So, okay, here's a hot question, and feel free to, you know, again, not answer whatever portion you think is not okay to answer. But one of the things that I think about a lot, and this kind of ties in with the whole anime and gaming thing as well, is that a lot of projects are kind of at this weird point in their lifespan, right? Where it's like, okay, we've dropped a PFP or we've dropped an NFT, you know, we've done like some cool shit and done some cool things for our holders and stuff. But where does that brand identity start to form, right? And I think the only one of the sort of, I guess, like, you know, let's talk about like these grail collections, which are like, you know, Nouns, Bored Ape, like, you know, CryptoPunks that have like a ridiculously high floor price. And then we kind of have the, you know, sort of slightly newer projects that are kind of hovering around the same range, which is like, you know, Azuki, I'd say like Artifact, Doodles, all kind of in that range. The question I have is like identity, right? Like, Artifact kind of has its identity as a consumer brand. They just do a lot of drops. They're kind of focused on like, you know, doing just products and stuff. I feel like, you know, I'm not really sure about Doodles. Again, I haven't really followed up with them too much, so I don't really know. But the question on my mind is always, where is Azuki's identity? You know, and I think it kind of has been the case that we've had like dope events and we've done just like some really cool shit. Airdrop was awesome. You know, what kind of comes next, and what is the identity for the collection, you know?
Yeah, I would say at the very least, it'll always be authentic to us. It'll be stuff that we think is dope and cool. Like, if, you know, like if I was a community member and I own this NFT, like, what would I find exciting or cool? I think like at its core, mm-hmm. it really is around like the characters that art has drawn. Like, they are the centerpiece of it all. It's really cool, and it's about how to try to like bring them more to life. And so, you know, I think we're really adaptable, and like, you know, I'm sure like through the past months or whatever, we've had constantly shifting ideas of what Azuki could be or what it should be, etc. But it's certainly very fluid and follows like the community a lot. And so, you know, without giving too much more away about like more concrete future plans around like what is Azuki, whatever, I think at its core, it's like, it's a brand that really embodies the community and the art that we've all like obviously love and we're here for, and kind of deliver amazing product experiences and stuff like that. Yeah, that's my answer without trying to give too much away.
Dope. Yeah, that's awesome. No, I'm excited to see. And you know, I strangely, and maybe this is like a weird thing, but I actually don't like speculating too much on what's coming next. I think people really like to do this, but for me, it's kind of just like, man, let it happen. You know, I think part of the experience and part of the ride is just like letting it play out and sort of being a fun, like being an active participant in what's going on. You know what I'm saying? So I am looking forward to whatever is coming next, but it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. I think especially at a time like now, right, where people are even questioning, like, you know, I guess a lot of people are leaving the space and bear market vibes and everything. It's an interesting one of just like, you know, how do you describe what a project is trying to do? Because people always ask, right? They're like, hey, what's Azuki trying to do? What's Doodles trying to do? What's, you know, this and that? And it's like an interesting, it's always an interesting thing that I think about in terms of like, I wonder what the right answer is for any of those projects. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that one's interesting on like the topic of like blue chips and stuff. Like, you know, we all know they've raised venture capital, and presumably a lot of those happened before the bear market. And so I think they're kind of pigeonholed into like, yo, this company is $4 billion. How do we actually justify $4 billion? Or like, you know, we raised tens of millions of dollars, whatever. How do we like actually justify this? And I think it's tough. I wouldn't say I envy their position, because like when you're stuck there, then you have to figure out how do we like actually like generate tens of millions of revenue a year. And it's a very awkward position to be in with like your community as well. And so it's either like you squeeze every last drop out of them somehow, or like you start thinking about how do you onboard like millions of like people into like your ecosystem and stuff. So yeah, so it's very interesting. I think we're just taking a very methodical approach, like what's right for us at this time, etc., and just doing dope shit. Like, I think it's like, it feels really tacky saying it, but I think at its core, it's like we just think about how to like do dope shit and create like amazing product experiences that will delight the community. I think there was like a tweet that Z tweeted out a couple of days or weeks ago about a combo we had, like, how do we top this or whatever. But yeah, we were like brainstorming some stuff. Not going to say what it is, but like we had spent like hours just like spitballing back and forth. And by the end of it, we like had like something pretty concrete.
Yeah.
And then I said like, okay, yo, if we pull this off, like what the fuck are we going to do? Like, you know, 6 months down the road, it's just like, dude, this is what we do, man. We just figure it out on the fly. So I think like if I were to really say like, what is Azuki? What are we doing? Like, I would rather kind of challenge the question to be more like, what's the team you want to back? Who are the people that like you just kind of trust will have your interests at heart and will, you know, trust that you can execute on whatever comes up, etc. I think it'd be really tough for anyone to say like, here's exactly how we're going to do this to grow to be worth, you know, billions of dollars as a company and justify like the MT or whatever. I think it's really hard to be able to just say something like that. And so, you know, there obviously will be some that just manage to do it. Instead of like, you know, trying to take a crapshoot on like who that ends up being, I personally think a better way to frame it is like, who's the team that we just trust to like take things like as they come, grow with the space and you know, figure things out.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. I think that's been my sort of case for Azuki since the beginning anyway. And I think, you know, it still remains true. I think you guys, again, it's kind of fun to just ride the wave and sort of see what comes out, because I think it's exciting for holders and exciting for people to, you know, kind of get behind that. And I think that's actually part of the reason why the community has so many fun initiatives as well, because I think the community is just kind of realized like, hey, this is something we really like. You know, we like doing these like fun things that everyone gets behind, that, you know, these fun experiences. So this whole like thing of Demna disappearing and then everyone with the ninjas and stuff, like, you know,
it was hell funny.
It's jokes. It was hilarious.
Yeah. All right. You know, real reveal. He was at Burning Man. But I think most people knew that. I remember, like, before he went, he was like, yo, so I'm going to be completely off the grid because there's, like, no reception there. And I was like, oh, yeah, yeah. And he's like, I tweet the most. Like, I think people really notice that I'm gone. And I was saying something like, oh, yeah, for sure. I'll try to amp up my tweeting, you know, try to cover your absence. And then, like, I started seeing all the ninjas appear, and I was like, oh, shit, I forgot. And then I was like, oh, shit, let me try to do something. And then so I spun that whole, like, tale of where he would go. And, small alpha drop here. The meaning behind those tweets is a little bit more than just he's at Burning Man. Also more than just the your mom joke at the end. So, like, there's, like, a third hidden, like, meaning behind it all. So if anyone can figure it out, that'd be pretty dope. But, yeah, I think when that Pepe video dropped, holy shit, it was so funny. Like, the Slack was blown up. Everyone was hella laughing and stuff. That's when Demna got reception, he tweeted his first tweet. I was hella mad, dude. I was about to DM him and be like, dude, what the fuck's wrong with you? Like, we had, like, the community and this Pepe video hella teased you up for, like, the perfect, like, bomb-ass tweet. Like, I was already, like, in the Slack, like, brainstorming how we can, like, you know, have his, like, grand return and stuff. Like, I was toying around the idea of that that Michael Jordan letter, like, when he unretired that first time. Like, came back. Like, I was, like, hella, like, thinking how we could do something like that. And he just comes back and tweets, like, some shitty-ass tweet. And I was so pissed. Didn't have shit for it, but...
That's hilarious. No, dude, the Pepe video was hilarious. I saw that randomly right before I went to sleep, and I was, like, blown away. I was speechless. I was watching. I was like, oh, my God, this is a work of art.
Yeah, that shit was so funny. Like, when I started the tweets, I had no idea where I was going to take it. And then at the end, I was just like, oh, yeah, this is what I should do. I was like checking my phone all the time, like, yo, please hit the number of likes required for me to tweet another one.
This is what I'm saying, though. Because I think, and it comes from the top, right? I think it comes from the culture of what you guys have built, right? Because it is this whole thing of, like, community and people vibing and enjoying the experience, enjoying the ride, right? And so I think in the absence of things happening because you guys are, like, busy working on stuff or, you know, doing your process, people kind of take that role of just like, hey, I'm going to become someone who just makes content or just, like, makes, you know, like, a meme and sort of creates this content. And maybe that's kind of an expression, just thinking out loud, but maybe that's an expression of what people are talking about with, like, you know, co-ownership of IP, right? It's not really like they're making products or they're making, like, you know, things. And we do get some of that, right? Like, people make coffee, you know, with a picture of beans on it. But I do feel like the richest form of community created content and stuff really comes from these memes and these, like, little movements that start completely organically that just become a thing, you know?
Yeah, 100%. Like, I think community generated content is really important. I think, like, it plays a huge part in the whole, like, building the brand together with us. Like, that is Azuki. Like, that Pepe video is Azuki. Everyone, like, you know, gearing up for the next great ninja war or whatever, like, that's Azuki. And so that's very apparent to us for sure. And a lot of what we think about and are working on and stuff is how do we kind of amplify that, empower that more, etc.
Mm-hmm. That's dope. I have one last thing that I did want to ask you about before we wrapped up, but obviously now we're kind of moving into this, and you kind of brought this up, you kind of alluded to this, but we are moving into this meta now where a lot of projects are starting to receive VC funding, which is great, right? Like, I think that's generally pro for the space, because I think it's better than, in my mind, fully crowdsourcing funds from individual people. I think that sometimes if we're just taking money from retail investors, especially projects that aren't really experienced, I think that kind of ends up not being great. Almost like very early stage, like, tech stuff before it was sophisticated in a way. And, you know, say what you will about VC, I think that taking money from an institutional investor or, you know, someone who's more sophisticated in that way is good. But do you see any issues with going that direction? Do you think there's this shift of people, you know, needing to be accountable to their VCs before their community? Or how do you think that all kind of plays out? What does that look like in a couple of years' time?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, because I think this trend is inevitable, and I think more VC money will flow into the NFT Web3 space. I think, like, the end result is certainly going to be better for, you know, the community. Like, you have, like, more established teams who can actually go raise funds, like, trying to build in the space, and it's overall going to be good. People have, like, ideas, new blood coming in, innovations, etc. I think the one thing that will be important is, like, the kind of the spirit or embodiment of Web3. you know, I think the Zugi team is very unique in that we are Web3 native, but at the same time, we come from, like, you know, more traditional corporate backgrounds. And, like, you know, if we had decided to, for whatever reason, start a company in the Web2 space for whatever, like, theoretically, we could have built products, you know, hopefully raised VC funding, et cetera. And so I kind of see us, like, at the middle of it all. Like, you had the very start, which is, like, crypto Web3 native people building products and stuff, but they're not maybe necessarily, like, you know, capable to, like, really take it further after the mint. Like, what comes next? How do you actually build, like, a business around it, et cetera? And on the flip side, or, like, where it's trending towards, you have, like, you know, Web2 teams that are, you know, with higher pedigrees and stuff coming in with VC funding. So I think it's just, like, I see the trend as inevitable. I just hope that, like, the teams and the products that get built just stay, like, pretty Web3 native and true to, like, the spirit of it all, I guess. But, you know, if I had to choose one or the other, I would still choose, like, this trend towards, like, more teams with, like, VC backing and stuff, just because you have less, like, random rug pulls or low effort things, I guess.
No, I totally agree. And I think this is one of the things that I kind of struggle with, is you see a lot of really good hype marketers, and that's the issue, right? We kind of moved away from that a little bit, which is nice. I think people start to sort of realize, but I do feel like people's attention spans are short with this kind of thing, right? And the next big hype thing will come. They'll drop some Unity assets or something, and then people are going to lose their minds and be like, oh my God, this is, you know, next blue chip. And it's like stuff like that. Like, that kind of blows my mind, where, you know, it's so easy in a way to raise money. It's so easy to just market without ethics, really, in this space. And then, you know, eventually take a shit ton of money and then just kind of be like, yo, I don't know what to do with this. And ultimately what they deliver ends up not being very good. So it is tricky. You know, it is tricky. And I think I tend to agree. I think that people, at least if they're vetted by VCs, there should be some level of due diligence that goes into that to make sure the team actually knows what they're doing, that they're not complete randoms on the internet, basically. And at the same time, there is that risk, I guess, of, like, VCs getting priority in terms of, like, thinking about what goes on. And that's that not so Web3 native aspect, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Elsie, I think a lot of the VCs in the space now do get Web3, understand it all, and, you know, probably have funded lots of, like, Web3 DeFi related stuff, et cetera. So they get it. But yeah, we'll see how things go when, like, more VCs kind of rush to the space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I guess only time will tell, but exciting times. And notwithstanding, again, the shitty bear conditions, I think it's great that Azuki is alive and well and project community is happy and people are chilling. Like, it's still nice to see the occasional tweet from someone who's like, yeah, I've been waiting to get in the garden for a while. And, you know, now I'm here and stuff. And that's kind of dope. And obviously everyone's very excited for what you guys have coming up as well. So
stay tuned. It's going to be dope.
Is there anything else you'd like to bring up? So you want to shill some of the hiring stuff or anything you want to mention before we start to wrap up here?
I mean, yeah, same shit. Looking for a recruiter. Let me know. There's a 2 ETH referral. So airport, you know anyone, hit me up.
Nice.
But yeah, I think just generally, thanks for being patient with us. I know, like, everyone wants to hear stuff. I think we really methodically took our time, like, as the bear market hit, to really, like, kind of readjust and reorient ourselves. Lots of plans were scrapped, things changed, etc. But, you know, that's all done now, and we've just been, like, in build mode now. So I'm pretty excited for the stuff that's about to come out. I think there's gonna be a lot of interesting innovation and product experiences, and hopefully the same, you know, dope shit that everyone kind of expects from Azuki.
Awesome. Well, that's one hell of a way to end the episode, man. So thank you again for your time, Location TBA. Appreciate having you on, and looking forward to next time, man.
Thanks, y'all. Peace.